Your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, then partly to mostly cloudy, lows 53 to 56. Patchy fog early tomorrow, then becoming mostly sunny, high 67 to 75.
They should be able to go to school or church in peace without the fear or risk of violence, and their parents should have the same kind of assurance.
In Minneapolis, a shooter fired into a Catholic school where children were celebrating their first Mass of the school year.
For Wednesday, August 27th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll have the latest from Minneapolis on the mass shooting, plus these stories.
What happens when the federal government owns part of a company?
How do Israeli media cover Gaza?
The first basic rule of ours is to inform, to report. And the Israeli media is betraying it.
And how Hurricane Katrina changed federal disaster response.
This is an example of government failing in a way that most Americans like to believe could not happen.
And later, a story about ebony and ivory.
The surprising relationship between ebony trees and elephant dung.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Once again, a community is grieving, this time over this morning's shooting during morning mass at a Catholic church in Minneapolis. Two children, ages 8 and 10, died in the pews where they sat. 17 others, 14 of them children, were wounded. NPR's Jason DeRose reports church leaders are expressing their sorrow.
In a statement issued by the Vatican, Pope Leo is offering his, quote, heartfelt condolences and the assurance of spiritual closeness to all those affected, especially the families now grieving the loss of a child. Archbishop Bernard Hebda of the St. Paul, Minneapolis Archdiocese issued a statement calling for the end to gun violence and saying, quote, our community is rightfully outraged at such horrific acts of violence perpetuated against the vulnerable and innocent. Archdiocese staff are working with Annunciation Catholic School to make sure families there have the resources they need. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara says the guns used in the shootings were purchased recently and legally by the suspect, who died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Control of the House will come down to a handful of seats in 2026, so the push from both parties for states to redraw congressional districts is picking up. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports.
President Trump escalated mid-decade redistricting by pushing Texas to create a new map, one that's expected to oust five Democrats. California Democrats responded with a move to get voters to approve a new map designed to get rid of five GOP districts. Sean Trendy, an elections analyst with Real Clear Politics, says increasing more solidly blue and red seats makes it even more difficult.
So it almost compounds things when you have these super safe seats because you have members who have just zero interest in even taking like an 18th.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries blames Trump and vows to take the fight coast to coast.
They started it, but we're not going to let them finish it.
States including Indiana, Missouri, and Maryland are now weighing new maps. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
The Department of Transportation says it's taking over management of Union Station, a major transportation hub in Washington, D.C. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says his department is taking management of Union Station back from Amtrak. The station, which is within walking distance of the U.S. Capitol, has been owned by DOT since the 1980s. Duffy says the department will now reclaim management of the station, which he said will help to, quote, make the city safe and beautiful at a fraction of the cost. National Guard troops have been seen patrolling the station since the Trump administration sent the Guard and other federal law enforcement officials into Washington, though local police statistics show that violent crime in the District of Columbia has declined in recent years. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. The city of Al-Fashir in Sudan has become an epicenter of child suffering, according to the United Nations Children's Agency. As NPR's Jonathan Lampert explains, 17 months of fighting there have left thousands facing starvation, displacement, and violence.
The capital city of Sudan's North Darfur region has been under siege by a paramilitary group for 500 days. The fighting has blocked aid from reaching the city, leaving 6,000 children suffering from severe malnutrition without treatment, according to the agency. More are threatened by fighting and an ongoing cholera outbreak. The conflict isn't restricted to El Fasher. Since 2023, a civil war has racked the country, displacing millions. The World Health Organization estimates that over 770,000 children across Sudan are suffering from malnutrition, leaving tens of thousands with life-threatening conditions. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration today approved the next round of COVID vaccines produced by Pfizer, Moderna, and Novavax. They target a new version of the coronavirus. This time, the federal government is restricting who can obtain the shots. In previous years, the vaccine was available to anyone 6 months and older. Now the vaccine will be available only to those at risk of serious complications from COVID, such as people 65 and older and those with other health issues that put them at risk. Stocks edged higher today, with technology stocks leading the way. The NASDAQ Composite Index closed up 45 points. The Dow rose 147. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
It is 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. The Cass Soil and Water Conservation District invites outdoor enthusiasts to their Woodlands for Wildlife event Saturday, September 6th at the Walker Area Community Center. Check-in begins at 9 a.m., followed by a presentation and discussion, and the event ends with a free lunch and networking. Register at casswcd.org. More news is next on KAXE.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In Minnesota, students at a Catholic school had their school day cut short by a tragedy today. A mass shooting killed and injured kids celebrating Mass at the adjacent Annunciation Roman Catholic Church in Minneapolis. At least two children died. 17 other people were injured. We're learning more about the shooter and the victims. Minnesota Public Radio's Peter Cox is with us now. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Ari.
Tell us what authorities are saying. How have they described what happened today?
So the mass shooting occurred at Annunciation Church and School in Minneapolis Wednesday at the church. The church is right next to the school. Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara said late Wednesday morning that the shooting happened during a morning mass, which was marking the first week of school in which children and adults were worshiping. O'Hara said the shooter appeared to do most or all shooting from outside through windows. They had a rifle, shotgun, and a pistol, and police say the shooter used all three, firing dozens of rounds. Police say it appears the shooter died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
And what more can you tell us about the shooter?
So the director of the FBI, Kash Patel, said on X that the shooter has been identified. Quote, the shooter has been identified as Robin Westman, a male born as Robert Westman. In 2020, Westman's mother applied to change the name of her 17-year-old child from Robert to Robin. In court documents obtained by NPR, the mother, Mary Grace Westman, wrote, "Minor child identifies as female and wants her name to reflect that identification. However, we do not know how the person currently identified, but the suicide note was signed as Robin."
Tell us more about the victims. This is a school for students in kindergarten through eighth grade. So those killed and injured were many of them very young. What do you know about them?
Yeah, that's right, Ari. We're still learning more about the victims, but we know two children ages 8 and 10 were killed as they were in the pews. 17 other people were injured, including adults and children. They were taken to two different hospitals in Minneapolis. An emergency room doctor at Hennepin Healthcare, one of those hospitals, said 10 patients were brought in, most of which were children. He said one adult and six children were in critical conditions, and others had non-life-threatening injuries.
Minnesota's governor held a press conference this afternoon. The police chief and mayor held one earlier. What did they have to say?
So it's been an emotional moment for them, as it had been for the whole community. Here's what Governor Walz had to say.
We often come to these and say, unspeakable tragedies, or there's no words for this. There shouldn't be words for these types of incidents because they should not happen.
And here's what Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said this morning.
Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying. It was the first week of school. They were in a church.
And Minneapolis has witnessed other shootings this week as well, but the fact that there were children in a school at this time was beyond troubling for the mayor. He said there are no words that can capture the horror and evil of this unspeakable act.
These are kids that should be learning with their friends. They should be playing on the playground. They should be able to go to school or church in peace without the fear or risk of violence, and their parents should have the same kind of assurance.
Peter, has there been any response from the Archdiocese?
Yes, Archbishop Bernard Hebda, who leads the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, thanked people across the world for their prayers for the victims and families who were affected by the shooting. He said, quote, "My heart is broken as I think about students, teachers, clergy, and parishioners, and the horror they witnessed in a church, a place where they should feel safe." He also wrote about yesterday's shooting in Minneapolis near a Catholic school, and called for an end to gun violence, saying these events are far too common. Hebda added that they need to work to prevent these tragedies from happening again.
This is obviously a breaking story, and I know you'll continue to update us as we learn more. Peter Cox from Minnesota Public Radio, thank you for your reporting.
You're welcome.
What happens when the federal government owns part of a company? That is one of many questions about federal policy right now as the Trump administration aggressively pushes for stakes and oversight of major private companies. This week, the White House announced it was taking a 10% stake in the struggling technology giant Intel. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick says the administration is considering similar moves with other companies tied to the defense industry as well. We called up Michael Strain to walk us through what this could lead to. He is the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative-leaning think tank. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
What was your first response to this Intel deal when you heard about it?
Well, my first response was surprise and concern. This is an unprecedented action by the U.S. government outside of a crisis situation. And even if you think that Intel needs more support from the government, taking an ownership stake is really just about the most aggressive way the government could provide that support.
This is an administration, this is a president that is very comfortable leaning on companies, people, organizations to do what he wants. What are your concerns in terms of two or three or four steps to line about how it could play out in real life? What are your worries? What are you thinking about?
Well, I think this is bad for Intel. You know, Intel is going to have to do a whole lot of things in order to maintain its competitiveness. And some of those things are going to be politically unpopular, like closing factories, laying off workers. You know, now that the government owns 10% of Intel, the government may pressure Intel not to do politically unpopular things.
Like, hey, we have to close a plant in this swing state for a financial reason, but now we might not do that because we're being told not to.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's going to be bad for Intel. Yeah. I think this is going to be bad for customers in the chip market in general. You know, if you're a business and you're, you know, taking government contracts, are you going to feel like you have to buy from Intel even if buying from Intel doesn't make the most business sense for you?
You said earlier, outside of a crisis. I mean, this has happened before in different ways. I mean, I think the most prominent example is the 2008 financial crisis. Shortly after that, the Obama administration took a major short-term stake in U.S. automakers. The auto industry especially, you could argue that worked out pretty well for the companies, for the markets. How different to you is this?
Well, I think it's quite different. You know, those were policies that were enacted during a crisis, and those were policies that were designed to be temporary. We are not in a crisis right now,
and the equity stake in Intel and the possibility of future equity stakes are not designed to be temporary. You know, if you think that Intel needs more taxpayer support, then you could extend loans under favorable terms to Intel. You could do greater subsidies to the semiconductor sector more broadly.
Can I ask you something on that point, though? I want to read you a quote from White House economics advisor Kevin Hassett, who said, in the past, the federal government has been giving away money lickety-split to companies, and the taxpayers have received nothing in return. And Senator Bernie Sanders, who I imagine is not one of your favorite members of Congress on policy, but the point is he's not normally a Trump ally, he's made a similar point. Is there an argument there that something like this is better than just a tax break or a subsidy or a bailout?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think that Mr. Hassett's quote, you know, really does reflect just a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the government in these situations. You know, the government is not one business out in the market competing with other businesses. The job of the government is to advance the prosperity and security of the American people. And that happens when American businesses are doing as well as they can to generate that prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, secondly, this is going to be bad for the taxpayer. This is going to cost money. The U.S. government has already given Intel billions of dollars of taxpayer money that could be used to fund hospitals or to reduce the budget deficit, or that could just be left in the pockets of the people who earned the money.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship is going to mean that more good taxpayer dollars will be chasing bad investments in Intel. So even if you agree with Mr. Hassett's frame, which I do not, I think this is still going to be a bad deal for the taxpayer.
I'm curious, Michael, if it feels kind of lonely at the American Enterprise Institute right now. I mean, this is a Republican president. You have many conservative voices going along with this and either not saying anything or agreeing or protesting in a very mild way. What do you make of this moment as a conservative?
You know, I think it's a difficult moment. I think it's incumbent on people in Washington who genuinely believe in traditional conservative commitments about the importance of free markets, the importance of limited government, the importance of the rule of law. It's important for those people to speak out. And I agree with your characterization that not a lot of that is happening, and that is troubling. But I think it makes it all the more important for people who are willing to speak out to do so.
Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you for talking to us about it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to People Powered, KAXC, and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Do you rely on KAXE and are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. If you have questions, you can call us at 218-326-1234. Thank you to everybody who supports KAXE. Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org. And the next summer Muse Festival is this Saturday, August 30th from 4 to 8 at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji with artists, musicians, food vendors, and more. Ripple River Gallery, located south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday 10 to 5, Sundays 11 to 4. Thanks for listening to KAXE this evening. There is more ahead from All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Hurricane Katrina made landfall in Louisiana 20 years ago this week. More than 1,300 people died in that storm, and the government response was widely seen as a failure. The Federal Emergency Management Agency became the face of that government failure. Katrina led to major reforms at FEMA, reforms that the Trump administration is now reversing, as NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
In the years since Katrina, a slew of research studies and official government reports all found the same thing. Most of the death and much of the destruction from the storm could have been avoided with better government action.
Katrina was a catastrophic government failure by every measure.
Andy Horowitz is a historian who wrote a book about Katrina. A lot of things went wrong, he says. It took days for federal search and rescue teams to get to the hardest hit places. There weren't enough helicopters and high water vehicles to evacuate people, and many residents suffered without basic food and shelter. As the nation's top disaster agency, FEMA was supposed to help coordinate those services. In the aftermath, there was a bipartisan push in Congress to overhaul the agency. One of the biggest reforms had to do with FEMA's leadership, says Craig Fugate, who ran FEMA under the Obama administration.
The FEMA administrator had to have relevant experience in emergency management.
The FEMA director during Katrina was a lawyer with a background in show horses who had a personal connection to President Bush's campaign manager. Every Senate-confirmed administrator since then has had a background managing disasters. Another big change after Katrina? Sending help faster. Congress changed the rules so FEMA could start sending resources before states asked for it. Fugate says this was a game changer.
You never get time back. So every step that we could speed up to move urban search and rescue teams, move emergency communications, move generators, meant that when the states did ask for it, it was already en route.
For example, before Hurricane Helene hit the southeast last fall, FEMA sent millions of dollars of equipment and personnel to the region so it would be ready as soon as the storm arrived. Another change, FEMA focused more on helping communities prepare ahead of disasters. Now, all those reforms didn't make FEMA perfect by any stretch, but experts say it was headed in the right direction. Now, the Trump administration has halted many of those efforts, with the goal of cutting spending and forcing states to take on more responsibility for disasters. The president has even suggested getting rid of FEMA altogether. Here's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who oversees FEMA, at an appearance with President Trump in June.
Sir, you've been very clear that you want to see FEMA eliminated as it exists today.
Under Noem, FEMA canceled billions of dollars for communities to prepare for disasters. And in a new policy, Secretary Noem has to personally approve all spending above $100,000. That has made disaster response slower, NPR has found. FEMA did not respond to questions from NPR about why the new spending policy exists.
To add an extra layer goes back to kind of pre-Katrina times.
Deanne Criswell ran FEMA under the Biden administration.
Now you have this extra layer of administrative burden at a time when you need to be as agile as you can to help the American people.
And after two decades of expert leadership at FEMA, the current acting administrator has no background in emergency management. This week, nearly 200 current and former FEMA employees sent a letter to Congress warning that the Trump administration has undercut FEMA's ability to respond to disasters like Katrina. At least a dozen of those employees were suspended from FEMA the next day, according to a statement by the advocacy group Stand Up for Science, which helped publicize the letter and spoke directly to those employees. Acting FEMA Press Secretary Daniel Yargue said in a statement to NPR that the administration is, quote, committed to ensuring FEMA delivers for the American people. FEMA did not respond to questions from NPR about the suspended employees. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
The world is connected in surprising ways. A new study gives the latest example, how African elephant poop helps make American-made guitars. As NPR's Nate Rott reports, the study also comes with a warning.
Let's start with the guitars and kind of work our way backwards.
My name's Bob Taylor, and I'm the co-founder of Taylor Guitars.
One of the most popular and best-selling guitar brands in the world. In 2011, Taylor and a partner bought a sawmill in West Africa, in Cameroon, a sawmill that specialized in ebony.
So ebony has a very mechanical usefulness on the guitar, and that's that is primarily used for the fingerboard. You know, the neck of the guitar.
Ebony is a tropical hardwood. It's rare, expensive, with a jet black core, and most importantly for guitars and other stringed instruments like violins, it's hard.
So that you could push a vibrating string against it, and number one, it sounds good because it's a hard surface to resonate with.
And number two,
that string isn't going to wear a hole in it within the first 5 minutes.
Not long after buying the sawmill and fixing it up, Taylor found himself wondering,
how much ebony is there that's even left? And what happens if we run out?
Was anyone planting trees? How are they pollinated? How do they even really grow? He looked online, asked around.
And nobody knows anything about this at all.
Then, in Cameroon, he met Tom Smith, a conservation ecologist from the University of California, Los Angeles, who'd been working in Africa for 40 years.
I had been interested in seed dispersal by vertebrates, generally.
How animals like birds and apes help trees move across a landscape by eating and depositing their seeds wherever they go.
Because in rainforests, generally, you know, about 80 to 90% of the forest trees require vertebrates to move their seeds.
Taylor decided to help fund a project that Smith would lead to better understand ebony trees and how their seeds, which are about the size of an apple, are spread. A guitar company funding science?
One of my favorite quotes from Jerry Garcia was, somebody's got to do something about this. It's just pathetic. It has to be us.
With the funding, Smith hired Vincent Deblo.
We started counting and measuring ebony trees in different forests in Cameroon.
Deblo is a tropical forest ecologist now with UCLA who's talking to us from Cameroon. And he says finding ebony is hard.
To find just one big tree, the type that loggers would cut, you have to screen an area that's like 70 to 200 football fields.
For help, he worked with a local indigenous community, the Bakaw. And during their outings in the rainforest, the Bakaw mentioned something interesting. They often found ebony saplings growing out of elephant dung. Deblo set up game cameras near some of the ebony trees they found. And sure enough, they recorded videos of elephants picking up ebony fruit off the forest floor with their long trunks. The Bakaw were right.
They correctly identified the elephants as the probable main ebony planter of the rainforest.
Here's why that's not entirely good news.
Poaching is decimating African forest elephants.
Smith says between 2002 and 2011, elephant populations in that area dropped by nearly two-thirds.
And this is all due to harvesting of ivory from elephants.
As a result, there's less ebony. In their new study published in the journal Science Advances, they found that in places where elephants had been removed from the rainforest, there was nearly a 70% reduction in ebony saplings.
You can think about Paul McCartney's song about ebony and ivory. It's about harmony between those two things. That's really important, right?
So to preserve ebony for guitars or furniture, just because it's such a unique tree, Smith says, we need to also preserve elephants. Nate Rott, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It It is 529. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxc.org. Our weather tonight, we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly to mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s, and patchy fog early tomorrow, becoming mostly sunny, high 67 to 75. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny, high 71 to 76.
For KAXC News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A 59-year-old Cass Lake woman died after crashing a pontoon onto the south shore of Leech Lake Tuesday afternoon. The Cass County Sheriff's Office says it received a report around 1:25 p.m. of a boat crashing into the rocks and shoreline near Walker City Park. Responders found the woman unresponsive in a 2016 Regency Tritoon. According to a news release, life-saving efforts immediately began and continued while the woman was transported to the Walker Airport, where she was pronounced dead. A 32-year-old Cohasset man died in an ATV crash in rural Itasca County Tuesday morning. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office says it received a 911 call just after 6 a.m. reporting a crash detected through an iPhone emergency alert system. When deputies arrived at the area of County Road 242 southwest of Cohasset, they found a rolled-over 2025 Can-Am side-by-side. The man was the sole occupant and was pronounced dead at the scene. A Beltrami County Sheriff's deputy and a fleeing man were injured in a head-on crash Tuesday morning. Larissa Donovan has the details.
The crash occurred in Eccles Township, northwest of Bemidji. The sheriff's office says deputies responded to a reported stolen vehicle at the Alpine Village Mobile Home Park. Deputies found the vehicle and attempted a traffic stop. The 26-year-old driver from Bemidji fled, leading a pursuit down gravel roads and snowmobile trails. While the driver was southbound on Grant Creek Road, a deputy was northbound with emergency lights on. The two collided head-on, causing extensive damage to both vehicles. Both were treated for non-life-threatening injuries. The driver remained in custody awaiting formal charges as of Wednesday morning. Larissa Donovan, KAXC News.
Filings are open for a special election to the Boys Fort Tribal Council. It is the band's second special election this year. The winning candidate will fill the District 1 vacancy left by the resignation of Representative Perry Drift. Drift left the council in mid-August, a few days after being charged with driving while intoxicated, according to the Timbersey newspaper. His resignation follows months of turmoil after an April altercation at Fortune Bay Casino, including multiple censures from the tribal council and ethics complaints. Drift was first elected in 2024. His resignation follows that of Chair Kathy Chavers, who stepped down in January to focus on her mental health. Enrolled band members who live on the Boys Fort Reservation can file until 4:30 p.m. September 4th. Candidates should file with Secretary Treasurer Tara Gieschick or the band's executive assistants. The election is set for December 29th. If more than two candidates file, a special primary will be October 28th. Three Northern Minnesota projects will receive funds from the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. The agency announced it was loaning or granting out more than $236 million in award funds for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects. More than $15 million in loans and grants are earmarked for the city of Aurora as it works to build a new water plant, renovate existing buildings, and upgrade electrical and mechanical systems. About $3.5 million of that is a 20-year loan at a low interest rate, leading to savings of about $420,000 for the city. Aurora's new building will replace a water treatment facility that was built in the 1950s. The city of Chisholm was awarded more than $890,000 to replace lead service lines with copper. The city of Hackensack received more than $960,000 to construct a water main in conjunction with the Minnesota Department of Transportation's project on Highway 371. The public will be able to access some private property starting Monday through the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Walk-In Access Program. While the program is geared toward providing access for hunting, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources says more than 20,000 of those acres are also open to other public uses, like birdwatching and nature photography. There are walk-in access sites in four northern Minnesota counties: Cass, Norman, Becker, and Mahnomen. Visit kaxe.org for more information. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. There's a widening gap between how Israelis and the rest of the world perceive the war and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Much of that is due to how the Israeli media portray the conflict at home. Some Israelis say that their media have abandoned their most essential role, that of keeping the public informed. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us more.
If you turn on Israeli TV, you won't see what you'd see on CNN or BBC when it comes to the war in Gaza, says Dalia Shendlin, a public opinion researcher and columnist for Israel's left-leaning and oldest newspaper, Haaretz.
The angle is almost always this very innocent, well, we're fighting this war. Yes, there's lots of destruction and people are moving, but, you know, here's our latest operation, and this is what happened when those soldiers were killed. The story of Palestinian civilians is never at the center.
Shendlin says that as long as hostages are being held, Israelis will not be able to move past the trauma of the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack.
Denial is denial. And if you deny crimes, you deny crimes.
Gideon Levy is on the editorial board of Haaretz. He's referring to his recent column equating Israelis' denial of starvation in Gaza with denial of the Holocaust. Levy says Haaretz is the only mainstream media covering the starvation and suffering in Gaza, though its readership is tiny.
Let's put aside opinions, ideologies. The first basic role of ours is to inform, to report. And the Israeli media is betraying it.
For commercial reasons, he says, they don't want to lose readership and viewers. But the international media's coverage of Gaza is starting to pierce the Israeli bubble.
Alors que plusieurs centaines d'ONG, vous l'avez dit,
the country's top news program recently ran a segment on how the foreign media are covering starvation, though the framing was Israel must do a better job getting its narrative across. But maybe it's time to understand this isn't a PR failure, but a moral failure, said star anchor Yonit Levy. That one line triggered an online backlash. Levy was called a Hamas spokeswoman and accused of spitting in the face of Israeli soldiers. In another incident, French-Israeli journalist Emmanuel Elbaz Phelps brought up Gaza starvation on a talk show.
Okay.
This needs to be said, she insisted, as the anchors try to cut her off.
Emmanuel,
with all due respect, says one anchor, I don't need to worry about what's happening in Gaza. Ariel Kahana writes for Israel Hayom, a conservative daily. He admits Israelis don't have much room for Gaza suffering after they saw people across Gaza celebrate the October 7 Hamas attack. Yes, there is destruction, he says, but Israeli journalists don't believe there is starvation.
It's a war zone, no question about that. But you saw the markets in Gaza are working even in the most difficult times. Of course, you saw the Hamas terrorists fed very nicely. So it tells you that there is probably enough food. On top of all that, many of the reports in the international media, it was clear that it was fake.
He says Israelis are used to, quote, Western media campaigns against us. Last week, a UN-backed panel of international food security experts said famine had taken hold in northern Gaza. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called that, quote, an outright lie.
Shalom.
Anat Saragusti is in charge of press freedom at the Union of Journalists in Israel. She says the media's failure to cover Gaza is actually dangerous for Israel.
It creates a gap between what the international community is seeing coming out of Gaza and the atrocities and the starvation, and the Israelis are seeing none of this. And then the Israelis tend to think that criticism against the policies of the state of Israel is anti-Semitism.
Turning on the TV, Saragusti sees something new.
Building by building, Gaza is being erased. Cities like broken skeletons laid waste by war.
A British report from a plane dropping aide shows the pulverized landscape below. An Israeli commentator tries to downplay the footage, but Saragusti says the Israeli media are starting to lose control of the narrative.
Now these airplanes coming from Canada, UK and other Western countries carrying real journalists with real cameras that take aerial shots of the destructions in Gaza.
Until now, international journalists have not been allowed into Gaza unless accompanied by Israeli troops. 27 countries just signed a joint statement demanding that Israel allow media in to report the full truth of this war. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Okay, you probably know by now that if somebody comes up to you asking to spill the tea, they're not going to dump a mug of hot Earl Grey on you. They want gossip. But when was the shift in vernacular? NPR's Alana Wise dug in.
What's the haps? What's the hot goss? Or even what's the 411? All of these were ways of asking, what's tea? But how did we get here?
It didn't originate online, and there's not one real entry point that we could say, like, oh, this is definitive the source of the word.
That was Amanda Brennan, a meme culture expert who is known as the internet librarian. Tea can be traced back in writing as early as the 1970s. Anthropologist William G. Hawkswood wrote the 1991 book, One of the Children, Gay Black Men in Harlem. The author talks about Black gay men using the phrase tea, which he defines as gossip, like the kind ladies might share over an afternoon brew. He describes the phrase as uniquely Black and originally Southern. Decades later, tea is no longer confined to Black or gay spaces. And like so much internet culture, Amanda Brennan says that can probably be traced back to a meme.
So in 2014-ish, there started to be a lot of memes of Kermit the Frog. And one specific one, looks like it was posted to Tumblr, was a photo of Kermit the Frog sipping a Lipton tea.
The image was from an ad that featured Kermit pulled from peaceful Sesame Street and thrust into an animal-packed Times Square. The Kermit sipping tea meme was also known as, but that's none of my business. It saw everyone's favorite amphibian drop his pleasant persona in favor of dropping hard, sometimes crass truths about the meme's recipient, Brennan says.
Oh, you have a girlfriend? You didn't have one two nights ago when you were doing something inappropriate for me to repeat out loud, but that's none of my business. A lot of these are quite inappropriate.
From there, it was an easy verbal leap from Kermit sipping his tea to spilling it, and an internet phenomenon was born.
But I think in mainstream culture now, like, tea equals gossip. Maybe, like, your mom would say it to you. My mom has definitely said it to me.
So if you've been wondering what's the tea on tea, well, that's tea. Alana Wise, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For the past few years, a small team of scientists at the CDC set out to answer some basic questions about drowning, like who is drowning and where, in lakes, rivers, swimming pools, and what works to prevent drowning. NPR's Ping Wong reports on why those answers may not come to light.
Lindsay Mondick got especially concerned when she saw deaths from drowning spike during the pandemic.
After the pandemic, quite a few organizations came together to really drive some possibilities of federal-focused work in drowning prevention.
She leads aquatic strategy for the YMCA nationwide, and those efforts created a small but mighty drowning prevention team at the CDC. Mondick says the YMCA has a water safety approach they've been using for a decade.
It's really focused on developing skills, right, for swimming and water competency, those skills that keep people safe if they were to have accidents or find themselves in an unpredictable situation.
And the CDC was helping them collect data to figure out what was working.
One of the things that we were most excited about with this funding is the YMCA was able to build what is probably the largest drowning data collection hub.
As part of the process, the CDC funded free swim lessons for kids at high risk of drowning, like those from some minority groups, and kids on the autism spectrum, who are 160 times more likely than their peers to die from drowning, according to a Columbia University study. Jennifer Pewitt oversees swim programs for the Y in the Dallas, Texas metro area.
For a kid with special sensory needs, not only are their senses being challenged because of just water, right? But it's noisy and it's hot.
At one facility, they got special training for swim instructors on connecting with kids on the autism spectrum. Pewitt says when parents heard they were running this program, they came from all over the county.
There's a huge community need. And so there have been some really awesome stories that have come out of it and some people that have had just amazing experiences, and there's been some misses.
That's the learning process. And the whole time, they collected data with guidance from the CDC.
The Y doesn't employ epidemiologists. Like, that is not a thing.
The goal was to figure out how to best teach kids at high risk of drowning and to share those lessons widely.
Because that's where the magic happens, right? Is if what happened that worked with these kids can be replicated. And I think that was the whole point of it.
Now, that work is languishing since the Trump administration put the CDC team on leave in April and terminated them this month. Jim Mercy is the former director of the Division of Violence Prevention at the CDC, and he says the CDC program costs just $2 million a year.
It's a very small program, but very important. And there was a lot of interest across the aisle in terms of addressing drownings.
Drowning is the leading cause of death for children ages 1 to 4. And he says one drowning death costs millions of dollars in terms of medical costs and loss to society.
So if that program saved one life, that would be far more than the total cost of the program.
For the past 3 years, the CDC has given most of that funding to partners like the YMCA. Pewitt in Dallas says that especially in small towns, cutting off the CDC money would be a big loss.
That's really sad that there isn't going to be those opportunities for those small Ys to serve the kids in their community.
The Trump administration has proposed canceling the program entirely in its fiscal year 2026 budget. The Department of Health and Human Services did not respond to a request for comment. Ping Huang, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things: a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station, an extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Thank you so much to everybody who supports KAXE. It is 5:49. Thanks for tuning in to All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, Sarah is your volunteer host for On the River. She'll bring you a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Programming is also supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. A lot has changed in the past year. The speed limit has not. Speeders can expect to be stopped. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. Weather for tonight, we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly before 9 p.m., partly to mostly cloudy, lows 53 to 56. Patchy fog early tomorrow, then becoming sunny, with highs 67 to 75.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. 4 years ago this month, the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan and the U.S. withdrew. Chinese investors quickly stepped in as Kabul faced Western sanctions. Their first major investment was in oil fields, but that deal recently fell apart. The Taliban and the Chinese company are trading accusations at each other. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, the saga sheds light on the often opaque relationship between Beijing and the Taliban.
In 2023, Afghanistan's Ariana TV network News showed turbaned officials and hard-hatted engineers turning on oil wells in northern Afghanistan's Amudarya River Basin. China and Afghanistan signed a 25-year contract to produce oil, with China pledging to invest $540 million in the first 3 years. But after 2.5 years, the deal fell apart, with both sides blaming each other. Two Chinese employees of the joint venture, Afchin Oil and Gas Limited, spoke with NPR. They requested that we not use their names or voices because they feared retribution from the Chinese government and the Taliban. We use voice actors to read their quotes. One employee explained what happened to his colleagues in June.
The Taliban forcibly took over our joint venture oil fields and unreasonably drove our Chinese personnel out of the oil field at gunpoint.
He says the Taliban detained 12 Chinese employees in Kabul and confiscated their passports. In June, Afghanistan's Ministry of Mines and Petroleum said it was canceling the contract because the Chinese side didn't deliver promised investments or pay royalties on time. The Chinese company disputes this account. Their employee said the Ministry of Mines sent them a private verbal message offering a deal.
They told us, you give us a written pledge saying you're voluntarily terminating the contract and we're not forcing you to do it.
He says that they also demanded that the Chinese side leave them all their equipment and their Kabul bank account with millions of dollars in it.
If you do these three things, I reckon you'll get your passports back quickly.
The Ministry of Mines and Petroleum did not respond to repeated requests for an interview. One Afghan source with direct knowledge of the situation confirmed that Chinese employees' passports were confiscated, but denies they were detained. He requested that his name and voice not be used because he wasn't authorized to speak to the media. After the U.S. withdrawal 4 years ago, China was the first country to appoint an envoy to Afghanistan. A second Chinese employee said his company did not invest in Afghanistan just for financial gain.
We had hoped that we could help them develop, improve citizens' lives, and help their interim government to function and be stable. Their stability is good for China and China's Xinjiang region.
Xinjiang borders eastern Afghanistan. The second employee says the oil fields created thousands of jobs and millions of dollars in revenue for the Afghan government. But the Taliban was still not satisfied.
Their business mindset does not include win-win outcomes, like a bandit committing a robbery. They think, if I like it, then it's mine.
Last week, the two employees told NPR the Taliban let 8 Chinese employees return to China, while 4 remain in Kabul, and it's not clear when they'll be able to leave. This happened as Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi was visiting Afghanistan. The Chinese embassy in Washington said they were not aware of this case, but attach importance to protecting Chinese nationals overseas. Former Afghan diplomat Omar Samad says both countries need to protect their long-term interests in good relations.
I think that both sides, not just the Afghans, may want to
be a bit more sober about this and realize that this one particular deal may jeopardize overall relations if it's not handled properly.
Afghanistan says it's open to partnering with other foreign investors to operate the Amu Darya oil fields. But the Chinese employees warn that unless the Taliban treat foreign investors better, they're unlikely to find any new partners. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.
Ed People is a social media influencer with millions of followers, but he doesn't sit in a room gaming or giving makeup tips. No, he is out in the world asking people to dance, as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Wherever he goes, Ed People asks complete strangers the same question.
Can you teach me a free dance move?
Yay! He has danced with kids in Uganda. Young adults from Cuba.
One, two, three, four, six, seven, one.
And an older woman with long white hair. Ed People is in his 30s. He's tall and thin. He says he hasn't had any professional dance training, but he can definitely bust some moves. When you watch the videos, he and those who engage with him are having a blast. They teach him dances like the waltz and reggaeton, but also improvised moves with names like crawling backwards and washing the windows. Call it a happy accident of COVID. Before everything shut down, Ed People was working as a DJ and music producer in Belgium. He'd also fallen in love with salsa dancing.
I was taking classes, I was going to clubs, I was dancing all the time.
And then COVID hit and salsa dancing disappeared.
And I missed it very much. I realized how much importance it was in my life.
So as soon as things opened up in 2021, Ed People headed to a park looking for people to dance with. He found two guys and a girl dressed 1920s style dancing the Charleston.
And I thought that was so cool. And I came up to them and I asked them, would you teach me that dance? And I loved it. We danced together and I wanted to have a memory of it. So I took my phone out of my pocket. I placed it against my water bottle and I pressed record.
A friend suggested he put the video on TikTok. At the time, he had zero followers. But when he checked the video the next day, it had 9,000 views.
And I thought, wow, these people come out of nowhere. And I had three comments of people saying, oh, that's a very good idea. You should do that again. Can you do this in this city?
He admits he gets lots of rejections when he asks random people on the streets to dance.
And most people say get away. So, of course, you don't see that in the videos.
On his combined social media accounts, Ed People has some 6 million followers. He makes money from some of the platforms based on views and from brand partnerships. He now has a small team of video editors. He's danced with the elderly and senior centers and prisoners in the Philippines.
It was always about connecting with people and learning from others. The whole message of my own project is that dance is a very powerful tool for everything, whether you're dealing with emotions of joy or emotions of sadness, grief, or anger, or whatever.
The format of Ed People's videos is pretty consistent, so is the joy. But the dance moves are as diverse as humanity itself. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Alone. Alone. Qui dit études dit travail, qui dit taf se dit les thunes, qui dit argent dit dépense, qui dit crédit dit créance, qui dit dette dit.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Renee Haas talks to musician and activist Peter Gabriel about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future in creativity and innovations. From imaginable futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits.
at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. And you can find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media.